Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode featuring Dr. Joseph Toltz. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of the Sounding Jewish podcast. I'm delighted to have you, and I would love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Dr. Joseph Toltz. I am the Manager of Research Support in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Sydney. I am also a researcher in Jewish music, affiliated to the School of Languages and Cultures at the University of Sydney in Australia.
Wonderful. Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish music or sound and why this was such a formative experience for you? And in particular, what kinds of personal or musical experiences motivated you to want to study Jewish music?
Well, I grew up in an Orthodox synagogue, in an Orthodox household. And the earliest encounter with Jewish music I had was going to synagogue and listening to the choir. We had a male choir. And there was one particular piece that they used to sing at Yom Tov, which was a very popular piece by Solomon Naumberg, the 19th century French cantor, called Se'ul She'arim. And it was, you know, for a four-year-old, it was very grand and felt very exciting to sort of listen to this music. And from that moment, I was interested in encountering Jewish music. And after that, I did my bar mitzvah. I leined the parsha as well as the haftarah, and I davened musaf. I wasn't from not dati orthodox. It's not the sort of orthodoxy that I was from. I was from an orthodoxy that was sort of mixed observance in that sense, but definitely going to an orthodox synagogue where there was separation of men and women and all of those sorts of stuff. But the choir really interested me. I loved the harmony that they produced. And as I went through school, I became very involved in choirs at school. I was at a non-Jewish school, and it was a very good school in terms of music. But I was always singing non-Jewish music, lots of Catholic masses and Carmina Burana and requiems and stuff like that. And it got me to thinking, where's Jewish music in all of this? I started working as a chorister at a synagogue, and then I changed different synagogues in Sydney. So I started off at the North Shore Synagogue, and then I moved to a Reform temple, and then I moved to the Great Synagogue, which is the oldest synagogue in Australia, which had a very different musical tradition to other synagogues. Then I moved to Emmanuel, which was again a sort of a mixture of conservative and Reform progressive, and now I'm back in Orthodoxy. I like the sound of all male voices in a synagogue choir. It's just a preference more than anything else.
Can you tell me a little bit about your scholarly trajectory and how you decided that your initial research topic should be the one for you?
Well, my initial research topic was Jewish liturgical music, particularly during the 19th century, during the Haskalah. But this was sort of before the ability for us to sort of access archives digitally and all that sort of stuff. It would have been a nightmare. I would have had to go over to Hebrew Union College to look at the Birnbaum collection. I would have had to go to Israel, all that sort of stuff. And I grew up in a family where there were lots of Holocaust survivors, and I grew up in a community where there were lots of Holocaust survivors. One of the things that I would notice in my secular musical life was the amount of survivors and their descendants and Jewish refugees who were attending concerts in Sydney and were the backbone of audiences, like really the backbone in Musica Viva was a chamber music organization started by Jews in Sydney in 1945. And then we had the Sydney Symphony and the Opera. All of these organizations were heavily supported by Jewish patrons. And a lot of these people were survivors. And it occurred to me that music played a really important role in the lives of these survivors, beyond what I saw in the general population. And I was curious about that. I wasn't sure whether it was because they were survivors or because they came from a European background where they had that sort of approach to music as an educational and transcendent sort of experience. But it got me thinking that there was obviously music in Jewish experience during the war, and all the survivors around me were going, and I was wondering what to do. And so I decided to start interviewing survivors about their musical experience, about their musical experiences before the war, about their musical experiences during the war, and about their musical lives after the war.
Our room had an anthem, and
what was the anthem?
Shall I sing it for you?
Yes, please.
Jsme 0:15, by každý věděl, není v getě chlapce, jež tu neseděl, jen už se to houpe, už se to šoupe, už se to šponduje, vojna tu je. Byla tu Kamila, byla tu Magda, pořádku nenaučila nás žádná. To translate, we are 0:15, so that everybody knows there is no boy in the ghetto who didn't sit in our room. And then it goes, there was Camilla, there was Magda, but none of them taught us tidiness.
We'd started some exhibitions in Australia. The City Jewish Museum, which I had worked with when it was established in 1991, later on in the late 90s, they had a special exhibition that was about Theresienstadt. And the organizers of this exhibition asked me to program some music for my choir to sing at the opening of the exhibition. And that really sort of spurred me on, because at the end of the performance, I was accosted, I use the word deliberately, accosted by a Czech survivor who said, "We never heard that sort of music in the camp. Why didn't you sing something from Brundibar? Why didn't you sing something from The Bartered Bride? Why didn't you do something that was more accessible and more people had heard?" And that opened the door for me to explore. So I became very good friends with this particular survivor, and through him, the whole Czech Jewish diaspora in Sydney, which was at that time about 30, 40 survivors.
That's so fascinating. I want to come back to this project and your work with Holocaust survivors. But first, I'd like to just return for a second to your early entrance into Jewish music studies. Would you say that your study of Jewish music was shaped by your experiences in elementary, high school, graduate school?
Well, it's an interesting question, because what I encountered about Jewish music in high school was pretty much altogether negative. It was in the 80s, and this was a time when I would say in Anglo culture, Jewish music was not given the sort of respect and recognition. I remember reading books on Mahler, which derided his Jewishness as a part of his compositional output. I remember reading Wagner's Das Judentum in der Musik and feeling very uncomfortable about the fact that Wagner was put on this pedestal in Western concert music as an example of the apotheosis of tonal harmony. And this really disturbed me, and I decided that I needed to know more about Jewish classical music tradition as well as the Jewish folk tradition. I was largely self-taught in understanding the structures of Jewish music. There's no cantorial school in Australia. When I became a cantor, I I knew how to read the Talmud, so I could lane and I could teach Torah and Haftorah and I could daven, but nothing really codified. And to go to America and to learn that would have cost a fortune, and I probably would never have come back. So this is my home, my family are here, my partner is here, and my sister and my niece and nephew. And so I have strong roots in the community. My family came to Australia in the 1870s on one side, so really early colonial Jewish migration, which was really rare, and we still can't work out why they did it. I mean, it's a long way away from everything.
Where did you ultimately end up studying? Who were you working with? What did your sort of first Jewish music project off the ground look like?
Right, so I was never studying formally Jewish music. I only studied formally music. So I did a degree in music at the University of Sydney. My bachelor's degree and my honours degree was with Professor Alan Marrott, who is an expert ethnomusicologist in the music of Aboriginal people in Northern Arnhem Land, the senior lawmen of the Yolngu Nation in Northeast Arnhem Land. So my approach to Jewish music, because I brought this project to him as an undergraduate of interviewing Holocaust survivors about their musical experience, which then became my doctorate. But the honors project with him was taking an ethnomusicological approach to this type of work, trying to understand how do we communicate with people from, and even though it was from the same culture, it was also from a different culture because I'm not a survivor. I'm two generations removed from that experience. I had to wrangle philosophically how I would approach that, and I had to sort of examine the actual ethnographic interviews that I did with survivors to then sort of work out where I would position myself and how I would talk about this material.
That's really helpful. What kind of advice would you offer to a student who was in your shoes nowadays if they didn't feel like they had access, whether for geographical or other reasons, to somebody working directly in the field of Jewish music? How would you guide them?
Well, it's a different world. Firstly, thank goodness you've got so much access to so much material online, and it's just getting more and more rich and more accessible. The Holocaust Museum in Washington, for example, has so much digitized material, and it's very, very easy to access. Less so Yad Vashem, but they're getting there too. And I believe that the Hebrew Union College have digitized all of the Birnbaum and stuff like that. I mean, there's lots and lots of material out there. So I think that my advice to a budding scholar who wants to study Jewish music is find yourself a good supervisor. That is the most important thing. Find yourself somebody who is going to guide you on this path with sensitivity, with support, and then choose the sort of material that you want to examine. I would still think that studying in North America would be the best place to do Jewish music studies. It seems to be the place where it's all supported and where there's a really healthy culture. But I think you can still do it from distance. And you know, if you were doing it in your own language and you were examining your own culture, say in, you know, Slovakia or Poland or places like that, you could quite easily stay there and contribute really rich new sources to the field.
That's beautifully put. And speaking of great supervisors, who would you say some of your biggest mentors or advocates or role models throughout your journey have been?
One of the most generous people that I ever knew as a mentor was David Bloch, who was the professor of musicology at Tel Aviv University. His wife, Emily Berenson and Bloch, and I still occasionally are in contact, not as much as I should be. She's a wonderful person. She was a very fine singer. And David was a pioneer in examining the music of Theresienstadt back in the 70s. And then when he moved to Israel, when he made Aliyah, then they continued to work with that material. And when the wall came down and Prague was liberated, they were able to go into Czech Republic and interview significant people, as well as gather more material. He was a generous and delightful human being, and I still miss him. He and Emily hosted me in Israel when I was doing my PhD fieldwork. He came out to Australia and I hosted him. Philip Bowman has been very supportive of my work. He marked my thesis. He was the external examiner and was super encouraging and helpful. Linda Barwick, who is married to my first supervisor, Alan Marrott, she is a professor in her own right. And she's always been a huge mentor and role model for me throughout my career.
Awesome. Can you tell me a little bit about one of your most recently completed research projects about Jewish music and why you chose it and what has excited you most about it?
I've got two really exciting projects that I've just finished. Well, one that I will have just finished in about a day or so, which is completing a manuscript for the University of Manchester Press
Awesome.
called Out of the Depths, the first collection of Holocaust songs. And the second project is a film that I was co-producer and I was the concept creator for. It's called Singing Up the Past, The Songs of Gutta Goldstein. Both of these projects are related to my earlier work. Gutta Goldstein is a wonderful, healthy 94-year-old Holocaust survivor living in Melbourne and was a significant contributor to my doctoral thesis. She was born in Łódź and she was in the Łódź ghetto until 1944, then in Auschwitz, then Bergen-Belsen, and then she was in a labor camp in the Harz Mountains called Melteuer, which was a really good place to be for the last 3 or 4 months of the war because she was doing slave labor, but the work was administered by civilians and only supervised by the SS, and she had heated barracks. So pretty much all of the girls who were in this place were safe and survived. She was liberated at the age of 15. She has an incredible practice whereby she sings pretty much every day. When she sings, she remembers all of those past times, whether they be before the war, up to 39, during the war, or after the war. And every song connects to a memory.
This is the one that Carmela sang
That's
you?
Carmela wrote it, and at home they used to write it down. A few girls in there, because there was supposed to be some kind of something when Rumkowski was going to come or something, so they had to make it, you know. So, wśród wielu dzwonów jeden dzwon melodię sercom wpada ton. On nam piosenkę niesie tą. Co swym akordem zgodne są. Wszywamy tu w sukienki życia nić. Tu przy pracy można bajkę śnić. Nasza szkoła swoją sławę ma. Naszych serc godnym rytmem gra.
And so we've done this documentary. It's about 30 minutes. It's just been accepted into the Jewish International Film Festival in Sydney and Melbourne, which is great. And the documentary not only tells her story, and it's telling a story, a Holocaust story, but it's not about the Holocaust. It's about the use of music in her life. And as well as her singing in the documentary, we went to Poland to contextualize the songs in the places in which she had sung them. And I was in contact with the children's choir of the city of Łódź, and I did arrangements for them, and we sang her songs with the choir and recorded them.
Bawcie się, chodźcie w
And so that was really a wonderful and special experience for me, for the director, Tim Slade, and for Gutta, and for the children who are lovely and charming and really devoted to making this music come alive again. The songs were in Polish and Yiddish. The children's choir in Łódź sings Yiddish quite regularly as part of commemorations, and they've been on tour with their material, and they're quite good. They're really quite good choir. So that was a wonderful project that is complete and will be launched in October, November, and hopefully sometime in North America, trying to get into film festivals there. Then the second project that I have just completed is a co-authored book with my friend Anna Boucher, who is a professor of politics, and her specialty is migration. She is the granddaughter of the person who inspired the book. The book is a book about a book. So it's about the first collection of Holocaust songs that was created in 1945 in Bucharest. And it was created by a survivor refugee called Yehuda Eisman. And Yehuda Eisman and Anna's grandmother were travel companions on false papers all the way from Krakow to Slovakia to Budapest and to Bucharest. And it's remarkable what you can find out from a tiny little pamphlet. It's a material object that tells us about the songs that were given by survivors to survivors in those early days. It tells us about where the survivors came from and the circumstance of the song. And it's all in Yiddish. It's all handwritten by Yehuda Eisman's future wife, not his wife at the time, his girlfriend though, Flora Rom, who was from Vilna. And Flora Rom had her own amazing story as an architect before the war. She qualified in the 20s as an architect studying in Prague, and she was a modernist designer. So the designs that she puts into the book are beautiful, and we're hoping that we can convey that in the book. So what we've done is, and it's taken us 10 years, is we have traced pretty much every contributor to the book. Not everybody, but almost everybody. And we're telling their stories as well as telling the stories of the songs and presenting this as a beautiful object. So that's an exciting project that was just about to conclude.
Congratulations on all of those. They each sound very exciting in their own way. And I hope that they'll indeed make it to North America because I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'd love you to see it, and I'd like a lot of people to see it. What is wonderful about this film is that the director, Tim Slade, he's an award-winning director, and he's often, almost always, directed documentaries around music. And he's also really great at visuals. We found some incredible visuals of a early 1920s animator, an anti-fascist, anti-Nazi German animator, and she does like fairy tales. And Gutta's songs almost relate to some fairy tales as well. So it really works well.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible multimedia project.
Yeah.
So, thinking across media, can you tell me a little bit about the kinds of methodological models or tools that you find yourself most often using and how you developed your appreciation for them?
To begin with, when I was starting off thinking about interviewing survivors, I had to develop my own ethnographic approach to this. And I started off trying to work out the tension of between yourself and the other, because going and talking to survivors, you're encountering an experience that you'll never encounter. And how do you convey that in a way when you're conveying that on their behalf? How do you do that in an ethical manner? I started off looking through phenomenology, phenomenological examples and alighted on Levinas as a really pertinent philosopher who I was comfortable with. Levinas, I think, expressed this sort of notion of the self and other, the obligations of care that need to be extended between these two states of being that were very important to me. I then started reading some Deleuze and finally Jean-Luc Nancy, who is a sort of a post-Deleuzian philosopher still alive in France. And I really found that what he said resonated, and I use the term deliberately, with what my approach was, because he also talks about entendre and écouter, and sort of trying to go more towards écouter, the actual act of the sound entering your ear rather than you then trying to process. So it's about an openness, in a sense, of representation, a representation that allows the listener, the reader, the other of the other to sort of make up their own mind and imbibes them with agency to receive what you are saying so that they can then come to their own conclusions about what you are representing without feeling that you are imposing a particular meaning. That sounds very complicated and roundabout, but that's sort of the methodological model that I use. When it comes to archives, it's a different sort of thing because you're not dealing with a human interface per se, but you're dealing with something that a human has left for you to examine and to think about. And one of the big things is how do we encounter archival material with these sort of particular concerns? And how do we represent them when we're bringing them out of an archive to perform, to resound for other people? There's a lot of thorniness around that. So contextualizing archival material by making sure that the people who put the material in the archive are front and center, that their concerns and that their motivations are clear to the listener or to whoever else is going to encounter that. That is really important. I mean, for all of this, I've been guided very clearly by being in a country that is still grappling with its colonial past and not particularly well, in that we've had a lot of Aboriginal First Nations communities having to lobby for archival returns. And within that system, in terms of music, there's a whole nother layer of material that has concerns that go beyond what the person who is looking at the archive is understanding. They might not have the knowledge, they might not have the initiation or the right to look and to understand or even to listen to that type of material. So there's a whole heap of protocols that have to be put in place so that First Nations, and we have a lot of First Nations in Australia, have the right of veto, the right of control of this particular material, especially in the wake of the devastating effects of colonization that have sort of been part of their and continue to be part of their history. So that's a real challenge.
Yeah, I think as a Canadian, society here is asking similar questions about repatriation and return of materials up in places that they were not meant to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think we are in the same sort of, I think you're a little bit more advanced in certain ways, but I'm not sure. I mean, you have treaties. We don't have treaties.
In due
Yeah.
time.
Yes. I hope so.
So one of the reasons I was really excited about speaking with you, aside from the fact that you're my first guest on the podcast in Australia, was because you occupy a different kind of role than most of the other people I've had the chance to speak with. And so I wondered if I could just give you an opportunity to muse a little bit about how the series of different positions you've been in has, in some ways, aided with, and in other ways, made it challenging to do the work that you do.
I have a very strange career trajectory. And it's fine. I've never had a tenure track trajectory. I work as a senior member of professional administrative staff in my faculty, working to advocate for research and researchers in their work, finding grants for them and and finding opportunities for them. So my trajectory is that I started off studying English literature and history, and then I came back to music a little later. And then after I finished my music studies, I got a fellowship at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. for 7 months, which was life-changing. I mean, to be able to do nothing but read and look in archives for 7 months is such a privilege, and it was so eye-opening and wonderful. But coming back to Australia and centering myself here, I soon realized that there was never going to be an opportunity for me to teach in this country, nor was there ever going to be an opportunity for me to be employed in my area of expertise. I could have pivoted and done some more sort of generic skill set sort of teaching. I can teach oral perception and harmony and stuff like that. I just was not interested in doing that because I felt that I could teach and research my material and probably also the 20th century in a fairly respectable manner. But those opportunities were not afforded me. I mean, after you get to your 57th application for employment, you get the message that, I would have had opportunities in North America and possibly in Europe, but not here. So with that, it sort of focuses you in a different direction. It enables you to step outside the constraints and the time and the investment that one has to put into teaching, which is enormous. And I think way more than a traditional, what we would call 40, 40, 20 academic workload. I don't think any academics who work on a 40, 40, 20 workload in Australia actually work 40, 40, 20. They probably work 80, 40, 20 or 80, 0, 20. And I'm just too interested in doing research and realizing that research in performance. I had a great opportunity in 2014. Well, after the doors were opened to me by the Holocaust Museum to do collaborations in Europe and in North America, I started off with a worldwide university network grant with researchers in England. That became a British Arts and Humanities Research Council grant called Performing the Jewish Archive. That went for 4 years, and that enabled me and my co-investigators to do research and performance all around the world. And that then led to other collaborations. And they were wonderful. I mean, absolutely wonderful, those 4 years of traveling. I mean, it's not great for your health, 78 flights in economy when you're 6'1". It's a little squishy. But I never regret doing this. This was amazing. I was able to look at archives in Prague, in New York, in Israel, in England, all of which have given me enough material for research for the rest of my life, to be honest with you. And so I'm really happy in doing the administrative work that I do. I like helping researchers. That's part of my makeup. When I was a cantor at a synagogue for 13 years, I was also the person most in charge of pastoral care. So when you're working in research, supporting researchers, it's like pastoral care. I mean, these academics, they throw their hands up in the air and they don't know what to do. And you say, here's an opportunity. And would you like help with some budgeting? And how about you apply for this? And all of that sort of stuff. And we get the systems working better for them and generally trying to improve bureaucracy. It has its challenges quite regularly, but it also is quite rewarding. And the ability to have colleagues who allow me some space to finish projects so they understand is wonderful too.
Yeah, it's a really great answer, and I think will lend a kind of diversity and even maybe open up some possibilities that people who listen may not even have considered.
Yeah, I think that there's a real problem in thinking of the academy in its traditional format. I think it has reached its level of expanse. And it's possible that it may contract. I mean, we've had contractions, massive contractions in the academy in America after the financial crisis. And although things have bounced back, there's a far stronger emphasis, I'm guessing, on vocation-based training over intellectual training. It's certainly that way in Australia, and less and less sort of support for humanities, and this is a problem. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to give up. There are other ways of remaining engaged in scholarly activity, and I think it's really important for people to do that in order to not just to survive, but to sort of continue to keep themselves intellectually focused.
Are there any new research questions or subjects that are currently preoccupying you or directions you hope to move next?
Of course. There was a group of Jewish refugees who went to England before the Nazis invaded Poland. And Churchill, in one of his moments of great stupidity, decided to put them on boats and send them one boat to Canada, as you would possibly know, and one boat to Australia, the Deneira, over to just under 2,500. Among those 2,500 men, they were of Jewish origin, or they were Nazi collaborators or Italian fascists. Not a lot of Italians, I think about 100 or 150. Not a lot of Nazis, maybe 150, 200. It was the majority were of Jewish origin. Some of them hadn't been Jewish for generations, but they couldn't prove their non-Jewishness, and so they had fled. They were horrified that they had been tarred with the brush of being fifth columnists. They were sent out to Australia. They were treated very badly by the British on the boat. They had all of their luggage thrown overboard. They were forced to walk on the deck on broken glass. It was really unpleasant. I think there were some deaths, but I'm not sure. And the people were court-martialed afterwards. They got to Australia and they got to Sydney and they got on a train and they were sent about 700 miles inland in between Sydney and Adelaide to a tiny town called Hay. It's on the Hay Plain. It's a bit like putting somebody in Bowling Green, Ohio, but in the 19th century, if for your listeners, in that terms of that sort of like flat, and there's nothing there, and it's a perfect prison because you don't really need walls or anything like that. But what they did is they started creating culture, and so they started doing reviews and they performed because these were a lot of intellectuals. Freud's nephew was there, some other really famous and important intellectuals, some of whom went back to England, some of whom went to America, and a majority that stayed in Australia. And they did these reviews. And these reviews are great commentary on their circumstances and their experiences and their worries and concerns for the world. And they put this together, and we just recently performed it. We found the script and we sort of sourced the music. A lot of it was a real melange, like a bricolage of different trendy songs of the day. The Mills Brothers feature quite heavily.
The 60 seconds got together and they decided to become a minute. 60 minutes got together and they decided to become an hour. 24 hours kept ticking away. And they all voted to call it a day. But darling, in a day, there wasn't time to say how much I love you so.
As does Franz Lehár's two of his songs.
You are my heart. My darkness bright when like a star you shine on me.
And then all of the melodies from the Disney film Snow White, because it was such a hit at the time.
Someday we'll meet again, and away to his castle we'll go.
and they called it Sergeant Snow White. And they dressed in drag, and so in men's and women's characters, and they had a great time. And this kept on being reformed from 1940 when they were locked in Hay, 1941 when they were locked up in Tatura in northern Victoria, and then all the way to 1943 when they were actually in the army, because they'd all enlisted and they were in like sort of a reserve force that weren't allowed to go and fight, but they could do work on the docks and they could do fruit picking while all the Australian men were at war, and they became the 8th Employment Company. And they actually performed this at the University of Melbourne's Union Theatre in 1943. And so that's sort of prompted me and my co-researcher, Ian Maxwell, in theatre and performance studies to ask questions about what was happening in the 40s and 50s in Australia in terms of culture while there was still this massively strong Anglo-focused culture. I mean, there was still, there was that, but there was this huge migration. These were forced migrants, obviously, but then there was a huge post-war migration project in Australia right up until the 60s. And what happened to culture before Australian identities, the sort of the preoccupation with Australian identity started to manifest itself in the mid to late 50s. So we're doing some research and thoughts into that particular project, trying to dismantle the idea that there was no British culture before, whoosh, suddenly there was this Australian identity. I mean, nothing comes out in a vacuum. You know, there's always preparation, and it's often marginalized voices like migrant voices and women's voices that actually provide a foundation for culture to develop in those sort of circumstances. So we're going to do some research into that. That's one of my projects.
Yeah, it's amazing that you're also putting on these performances of the material as you're doing the deep thinking about what this could be.
It's essential. I mean, you know, that's the thing. This material does not exist unless it's in performance. And I know that that's probably still a controversial thing to say, but maybe not. I hope not. Without performance, it's something on a page lying in an archive. Through the process of performance, we discover stuff about this work that we would not otherwise discover through that process of taking something out and saying, oh, well, this is not complete, but what is complete, you know? So let's try and work out what they might have done, or and not be slavish to it. This is no sort of silly, you know, original reconstruction type of argument. This is, here is what we found. This is what we're doing. What do you think? And audiences loved it. It was a great romp and a lot of fun.
So we've come now to the final two questions that I typically ask every participant who joins me on the podcast. The first question is how you understand the field of Jewish music and what issues or challenges with this field of study you think that scholars today should remain attentive to.
Yeah, this is a really good question because it's a field that has been so self-conscious about its place and identity in the world since its founding in the 19th century. I think we should think of Jewish music in the same way that we think halachically about Jewishness. If we think about Jewishness halachically, stuff I'm talking about, what is it to be Jewish? It's a peoplehood. It's not a race. It's not a religion. It's not even an identity. It's something that has existed prior to those modern constructions in that sense. So I think what I'd like to think of it is in a phenomenological way, Jewish music is what is encountered by those who are in it. So Jewish music is in a liminal space in that sense. It's between history and culture and place in that sense. And I think that if we can think of it in that particular way, we can keep on doing what we do productively. I think that when we start essentializing it and cementing it into particular categories, that's when people lose interest. That's when people say, oh, okay, well, you've solved the question, let's move on. I mean, you know, Jewish music is exciting, it's interesting, it is vibrant, and it continues to evolve in these particular ways. So I'd like to think of it in those particular terms.
That's a great answer. Do you believe that there is such a thing as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound? Why or why not? If so, how would you characterize it? And if this question seems too essentializing, what questions about the music and sound of Jewish experience would you ask instead?
When you are encountering music that has an ascription of Jewishness in it, the first thing you ask is, do I like it? Do I enjoy it? Is it well constructed? Does it entertain? Does it have intellectual or even non-intellectual stimulus around it? And what is the creator of it, be that the composer or the performer? What does the creator say around its Jewishness? Do people even designate music as Jewish? I mean, you know, of course there's klezmer, of course there's Ladino song traditions, of course there's Yemenite women's song traditions. There's all those ones that have a definitive characteristic about them, but there's so much more. I mean, what makes John Zorn's music Jewish? What makes Broadway Jewish? What's Jewish about Broadway? I mean, these are interesting questions, but really, I think it's really more about what is it that you love. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it works, definitely. Well, okay. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. I loved speaking with you, and I'm sure our listeners will love to hear what you have to say.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's very nice to be out here in the sticks, 10,000 miles from all of you, and for you to be interested in what we do down under.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish Podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA,
and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Stahl Center for Jewish Studies.
Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Jonathan Brantman to discuss his ongoing work on media studies, anti-Semitism, and contemporary Jewish stars. Bye for now.